Design Alchemy, the podcast that explores creativity in flux. My name is Henrik Jan Gievink, and I'm your host. I talk with designers, artists, and other creatives worldwide about how they respond to shifts in the world and in their practice. During our conversations, we craft the foundations of their deeply personal periodic table of creative elements. What is their unobtainium, the dreams that keep them up at night? But also, what is their kryptonite, their creative roadblocks? Curiosity is my driving force. What are the transmutations and fusions that these individuals create? What changes do they observe in the world around them or inside them? I'm interested. How do they alchemically create something out of nothing? How do they transmute lead into gold?
Yeah, I wonder to myself, as somebody who's been a student of design for 6 years or more and spent $100,000 most likely on tuition fees, and now to see what's kind of going on out in the world with all sorts of new software and platforms and tools and just new things, like how relevant are all of those skills that I learned, you know, over the past 10 or 15 years? And do these new like alternative schools offer potentially a better solution for a fraction of the cost?
My guest of today is John Wagner. John is a graphic designer currently living in Bet-Stuy, Brooklyn, New York. Next to his work for commercial clients such as Microsoft and Google, he creates what he calls dummy books, small-scale publications for and by befriended artists. John and I met in 2016 in Mexico City when he participated in the Summer Sessions, a mobile summer school I co-organized on behalf of graphic design Arnhem. John and I share a passion for education. He started teaching 2 years ago, so I'm curious to hear his vision on this topic. In particular, I hope to hear about his experiences with different learning modalities as a student within the American system, but of course, also his experiences in the School Without Walls in Mexico. I'm super excited to talk to him. Well, thank you so much for having me, John, in your classroom, the classroom that you're teaching here at Baruch College. Do I pronounce that correctly?
As far as I know, that's the pronunciation. My mom loves to say Baruch.
Baruch.
Baruch. My mom says Baruch, and I always have to correct her. I believe the pronunciation is Baruch.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm really happy to have you. You obviously will recognize the room from your visit a couple of weeks ago, which was really exciting. And I will say a lot of the students have had really positive feedback from your visit. So
nice. Likewise. Yeah. Well, John, one question I always start up every conversation is I invite people to explain to the listeners that they're a designer without mentioning the word design or designer. Do you think you could do that? What makes you a designer?
Yeah. You know, funny enough, I had listened to the first episode of the podcast. Mm. So I think I was prepared for this question. And I think my response to that would be, and maybe this is true of other people as well, I have a collection of tote bags. Very, very large collection of tote bags from all over the world, including one tote bag that is full of other tote bags. So if that doesn't make me a designer, is like a hoarder of tote bags, I'm not sure what else that could.
Wow,
what that could be.
You crossed off a major one, and you have a tote bag filled with tote bags.
Yeah,
meta tote bag.
Do we all have those though?
I stopped collecting tote bags at some point. I have other ways to carry stuff, but yeah, definitely tote bags signifies designer. What's your favorite one?
Favorite tote bag. You know, I've been stuck on one for quite a while. I went to a design event in San Francisco in 2016. I don't have it here with me today, but it was a Bloomberg Design Conference tote bag. And I love that it includes the date. And at this point, it's, 7 years old or 8 years old? And one of the handles has actually frayed so much that it's broken, and I had to retie it.
Oh.
But I still can't quite like decommission that particular one yet. I'm sort of waiting until it's finally dead, and then I'll move on to the next one. But it's just a simple black tote bag with white text.
Yeah.
Yeah, just really meaningful, I guess.
Feels almost like a bookmark of that particular
moment
in time.
I would say so. Mm-hmm.
So maybe tote bags, they serve another purpose other than just carrying stuff around. They're also kind of,
Yeah, like they're sort of a signifier. Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure I'm not the only person who, you know, has this type of collection, not just designers necessarily, because I talk to a lot of colleagues who do the same thing.
Well, now that we've established you as a hoarder of tote bags, aka a designer, maybe it's nice if you introduce yourself a little bit. We know each other already some years. Maybe for the listeners who don't know you, who are you, John?
easy question. So my name is John Wegner. I'm a graphic designer. I currently live in Brooklyn, New York. I'm currently teaching at Baruch College, which we, you know, introduced already. I also have sort of a second life as a creative director. I worked at an advertising agency, and, you know, we may or may not end up talking much about that. But that is a big, you know, part of my life as well. We've known each other now for 8 years or 7 years.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, through our experience through the Artez. Mm-hmm. Is that the pronunciation?
Artez. Many people call it Artez, but...
It had crossed my mind. Artez. Yeah, through the summer school program in 2016 or 2017?
Yeah, 2016, I think.
Yeah, in Mexico City. And I would say a particular area of interest of mine is publication design. Mm. That's a class that I'm teaching here at Baruch, and something that I think that I've been working on over the entire, kind of the entirety of my design career. I started in my undergrad at a time when things were definitely moving towards like digital spaces, but there was still a pretty big focus on traditional print, you know, production mm-hmm. methods. So I kind of got both sides of the coin in that regard. And so, you know, I'm very capable of kind of working in any space that kind of comes my way. But I guess I'm in some ways nostalgic of the past, and I love print design. And so books and zines, I would consider myself to have more of like a DIY mm-hmm. Approach to design, like some of the examples that you might see on the table here in front of you. Yeah, a lot of DIY kind of making myself.
Yeah, cool. Well, there's indeed some really nice specimens here that you brought.
Yeah, so part of my like personal design practice has been working on this project I call Dummy Books, mm-hmm. Where I make zines and small DIY publications, mostly collaborating with other designers and other artists. And I guess I consider this, you know, if I think about my own kind of design journey as being centered around education and academia, whether it be like undergrad or graduate school, I consider this to be like the extracurricular activities. Things are happening either after hours or after school. And yeah, this is how I, express myself and try to kind of give a platform to other artists and designers that I am friends with or, you know, have some relationship with. So you're holding there a book called the Rabbit COVID Diaries, uh-huh. which is a collection of drawings. A friend of mine is an artist, Mark Quinlan. He's located in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And he's been drawing these illustrations of rabbits on cocktail napkins for like decades. And so we decided to get together and create a collection of his drawings that all speak to COVID in some way, shape, or form. So it's a collection of, I think, 40 drawings from his COVID series.
Here's two rabbits staring at the mirror ball, and one says to the other, "Remember dancing?"
Yeah, Mark has a very funny and interesting sense of humor.
So one thing you mentioned already, we met each other in Mexico City, doing this summer sessions program. At some point, I was an organizer of that, but we'll get to that. I think one thing that connects us, among other things, is that we are both design educators. So we thought maybe it's nice and useful and meaningful to start a little conversation on design education or both our experiences. Mm-hmm. as well, students within different educational systems.
Right.
Me in the Dutch system, you here in the in the US, but also our roles as educators that we are now, and what are our experiences in that, and what are the learnings, mm-hmm. and also what are our visions for the future. So that's something that I hope to learn more about mm-hmm. The next whatever hour or so.
Okay. Yeah. So I feel like I should say right off the bat that this is only my second year teaching. So while you may, I may introduce myself as a educator and you may call me that too, I'm very new at this, and I like to be transparent about that with my students especially. At first I thought it was something that I wanted to hide.
Hmm.
And, if they know that I'm new, that they're going to criticize me or constantly have, feedback and critique. But then I kind of realized maybe that's something to kind of lean into a little
bit.
And I love getting feedback. I love hearing firsthand accounts of, what I'm doing well, what I'm not doing well, things that I can get better at. And so, anyways, I'm still very new at this and I'm learning a lot every day, every week.
But that's so cool. And it's also something that I recognize so well. Maybe I have a few more years experience in that sense, like 12 years plus a little bit. But I also find myself every couple of other years reinventing what it means to be teaching. And of course, there's some basic stuff like talking in front of a group that you get a bit more comfortable about over the years. But I like, there's more like my life philosophy. I'm a student of life. There's so much to learn. And I think there's never a moment that, I think sometimes we have this assumed ideas of like, oh, when you're 10 years into this profession, you know all about it. Mm-hmm. And for some people that might be the case, but I like to see myself as a person that constantly learns. Mm-hmm. And at some point especially when you start up like doing new stuff or tweaking the way you do stuff, you'll find yourself in places that you have to maybe unlearn some things and relearn them. So I think what you say is, to me, it's just a very humane way of approaching things.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe just to dive in a little bit, where did you have your formal education, your training as a designer, and how was that experience?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, I started my undergrad education at a school in Chicago called DePaul University, and at that point, when I was applying for colleges when I was 16 or 17 years old, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Both of my parents kind of worked in business functions, and I didn't have a particular area of interest at that point, so I just kind of was applying as a business major. And during the first 2 years of my undergrad is when you're sort of taking your general education and those type of classes. One of the requirements was to take an art class. And so I remember I took 3D design. And one of the projects was to design a chair that could support your weight, built out of just cardboard and hot glue. And I thought it was so fun. I made this chair that was kind of like two diamonds facing one another that connected. And lo and behold, I was able to support my weight. And that was kind of my entry point to like what design really was. I wasn't really familiar with the idea prior to that. And then I decided to switch my major to graphic design. So I spent the next 2 years kind of going through the formal design education experience there.
That was also in Chicago.
In Chicago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. And what was the rest of the question?
Well, the question was just like, where did you get your formal training in in design? And,
okay.
And also, how was the experience? And yeah, you may include like the good experience or experience that you helped you grow, but maybe also some experience mm-hmm. that were less good or?
Yeah. Well, I will say, kind of connecting back to now being a teacher, I think part of the reason why I wanted to become a teacher in the first place was due to some of the people that I met who were my instructors, when I was in undergrad, when I was in graduate school, when I was, with you doing these summer programs. So I think my positive experiences were sort of working with these people who were giving assignments, who were teaching me things, and basically collaborating, you know, together to make projects. What am I trying to say? Maybe we can start over there.
Yeah, sure. So you were, maybe you can just talk about some good experiences that you had.
Okay. Yeah, so in particular, I can remember two instructors from undergrad. One was named Mark Smith. The other was named Zach Ostrowski. And both of them were just people that I feel like I connected with kind of on a human level, even beyond just being a designer. And Mark Smith is somebody who I would say is very interested in book arts. And so I think that's where I kind of developed this interest in working with books, making zines, DIY publications. And Zach also has a really interesting practice. He graduated from Cranbrook Academy in Michigan, and he comes from more of like, I would say, artistic practice. And yeah, both of those people were just, I was very impressed with what they were doing, and I sort of felt like, oh, I want to be, you know, kind of like them. And so I would say that's kind of what led me to wanting to be an instructor, ultimately. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's been so long even since my undergrad experience that I'm kind of like lost touch with it in some ways. But overall, I would say I had like a positive experience with my education. If I knew that I wanted to be a designer, ultimately, I think I would have probably tried to go somewhere else, like a dedicated art school, like an arts institution.
Right.
But like I mentioned, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was 16, and I'm not sure how many people really do. So yeah, I kind of fell into it.
Cool.
But it allowed me to move to Chicago and see like a whole part of the world that I had never really been exposed to in the past.
Do you feel that there are particular experiences during your training that you felt challenged or lifted, or that really helped you grow as a student? Mm-hmm. What were they?
Challenges. Can we come back to that one?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah. Let me simmer on that one.
I'm just thinking about like one particular experience that I had. I had varying experiences in my formal training in my during my bachelor. That I had a few teachers who were really old school, like really kind of Bauhaus style. I think already when they were teaching, they were in their 60s, almost reaching retirement, and this was mid 90s. Okay. So they were really like old school people.
Yeah.
And one of them, and his name was Joop Hilskamp, and he was this old guy, guy with a kind of a frown, and he would have these amazing stories every week about his journeys. He lived in Japan, he lived in New York. So every week he brought something, some vision. He explained yin and yang concepts to like me being 18 years old. So for me, that person, he really opened the world. And I remember one day when we got into class and he brought a chair. And he brought it all the way from Amsterdam in the train, taking at least an hour and a half to get to the school. And he put the chair on the table and we were all like facing him and facing the chair. Like, who knows what chair this is? Like, everybody was like, clueless. Turned out it was an Eames chair, you know, the classic Herman Miller kind of. And none of us had ever heard about Charles Eames. And he started his whole story about Charles and Ray Eames. They were a couple, they're a husband and wife, but also about the masculine energy, feminine energy, yin, yang, those kind of very holistic approach to design. And that was like unlike anything I had heard before at the time. So those kind of, this is just one thing that I remember, was really this kind of experience that opened up a world to me. And then the world that I was also very interested in, like, oh, there's so much more to say about all the objects around us or everything that we see. It's not just, we don't have to take it for granted how these things come together. It's like all you know, life philosophies behind it, or if we want, we can discover this world around all these objects.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember something like that, or something that a teacher told you, or somebody, or whatever somebody once said to you? I'm just always very curious, like what makes good education and what makes great education?
For me, I would say the most positive part of my education is kind of the creative community that I've been able to meet and, you know, make networks with. At every stage, you know, you're meeting, we met, you know, I now have this kind of global network of people that live all over the world, in Mexico, in the Netherlands, in Canada, in South America, in China, in Japan. And, you know, none of that would have been possible without my experience sort of meeting and interacting with these people in classrooms and, you know, in summer school in Mexico City. And so I think that's like a really positive aspect of my design education, is just kind of the networking community that we're able to build. Both like, yeah, just that network, I would say.
So maybe I can hold something against you. Just my outsider perspective of, well, I'm now here in New York. And I just, my knowledge of the American system here is quite limited.
Mm-hmm.
But I've spoken to some people, I look around. So one, my image of education here, it may be in general, but let's stick with design education, is that, well, tuition fees are quite high, mm-hmm. compared to, well, especially compared to the Netherlands, where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, well, if you want to study here, many students end up with quite a big loan.
Right.
So then your first goal after graduating is landing yourself a job to pay off your study
tuition.
Your tuition, what's your debts.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember some conversation I've had in the past where we also asked with somebody in education here, like, okay, what are you training your students to? Are you training them to be, you know, like artists, designers, mm-hmm. or are you training them to land that job?
Right.
And I feel that here, what I tend to see is more kind of that cycle of education is very much geared to the professional world,
mm-hmm.
training students to find a job, and to make a living for themselves, which is of course is very it's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, like the education that I've experienced myself in the Netherlands, but also that I'm the educational institution Artes, where I'm part of, I would say the design education is more embedded in arts education.
Right.
Where we train, of course, you train students to become professionals and to have all the professional skills that they need to, well, not only survive, but thrive in a professional environment. Mm-hmm. But next to that, also, adopt more maybe like critical or creative, artistic mm-hmm. mindset. So how would you, maybe I'm painting too much of a black and white picture here, but I'm curious about your perspective on this.
Yeah, I would say my perspective is definitely in line with what you just talked about. As you know, I'm not as familiar with the sort of European education system at all. And I think what you just said is like exactly what everything that I've heard about, you know, what's going on over there. And yeah, I would agree, at least the institutions that I'm familiar with that I've been involved in are much more geared towards students graduating, moving on, finding jobs, you know, making comfortable lives for themselves. And that's definitely kind of a characteristic of the places that I've been, including this, you know, this school, Baruch. One of the things that I'm actually really proud of working here, Baruch is part of the CUNY system, which is the City University. And the
tuition, City University of New York.
Exactly, CUNY, University of New York, which you'll hear referred to as CUNY. The tuition fees at CUNY schools is actually very affordable. And you know, students will, of course, graduate here and still have some type of debt, but it's a much more, you know, realistic and kind of reasonable debt to deal with at the end of the day. And so a lot of the students that end up coming through this program are first generation college students, you know, immigrants, non-traditional students. Maybe they have kids or other responsibilities outside of just being here in school. And so I think Baruch is actually a really good example of, you know, prototypical American institution design.
That's beautiful. And so I can attest to that because I've been here a guest, and that's also in line with what I what I saw and experienced. And it's maybe different than if I look, for instance, at the school where I teach, Artes. It's now different, but when I started there like 12 years ago, it was much more, the student population was less international, more Dutch. It's a school, it's not in the, it's not like in Amsterdam, it's in Arnhem, which is more in the east of the country. It's a bit more in the periphery. So typical students would come from, let's say, Dutch middle-class families, which is, well, it's totally fine, but it was a kind of, I'm not saying like a monoculture, but more, it has a specific demography, students coming from quite specific
backgrounds,
where the past years it has become much more international. Schools open up and we get students from, at least from different ethnicities, but hopefully also different social backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the CUNY system is one of the most like diverse institutions in the country and probably the world too. So I think what's really unique and kind of special about the dynamic of our classes is that they're so diverse. It's kind of the opposite of what you're just talking about. People coming from all walks of life, people coming from all types of backgrounds. And I really love because then I get to see, you know, those points of view coming through in their work.
Yeah.
And so that's really exciting. Like one of the things that I really try to do is help students insert their particular point of view or their background into whatever they're making. And so it's, you know, a lot easier to do at a place like this where people come with very particular or special or unique backgrounds.
Yeah, great. Maybe hold that thought for a while because we'll get back to the end of the conversation. No, we're going a bit back and forth, but that's totally okay. Maybe it's nice to talk a little bit about the summer session program where we met each other. Mm-hmm. We've referenced it a couple of times. Maybe it's nice to explain it a little bit to the to our listeners what that program was. The summer sessions were a mobile summer school initiated by the graphic design department of Artes, where I'm also a teacher of. I initiated that and co-organized that program at that time with Thomas Castro, who was at that time head of the department. I was also the organizer of that program. And between 2013 and 2018, we had editions of that summer school in Nida, Lithuania, Beijing, China, Detroit here in the US, Mexico City, Tokyo in Japan, and in Arnhem in the Netherlands. And the idea of the summer school was that it was structured around the idea of design research. And the idea was that it was a two-week program. The first week was very much focused on input, like field trips, workshops, excursions. And the second week was more focused on output, like actually making something that would result in an exhibition. And we would always encourage all the participants to be kind of embedded in the location that we were in. So like working with local researchers, craftsmen, etc. And one thing that I liked about it, we never kind of branded it officially like that, but we called it sometimes like a school without walls. So what we would do is we would go on a research trip, in this case to Mexico City, with me, my colleague Femke was organizing with, and a usually a local guide or a helper, and we scout for locations to host a group of 20 people, but also find a workspace to accommodate everyone. And if we managed to bring it all together, it was always so exciting to bring together a group of between 15 and 20 people from, I would say, like all over the world, but yeah, from different places, mm-hmm. and who didn't know each other, and spend 2 weeks together and do stuff. And this, I think, also where you come in, where we met each other, because at that point you were one of the participants. I was organizer, so I'm very, very curious. It's a couple of years ago already. But how did you experience that? And why did you sign up in the first place? And how did you experience it?
Right. Yeah. So I remember learning about the program through my thesis instructor at CCA, John Zueda, who I believe was good friends with Thomas.
Yeah.
And so John introduced his students, including me, to this program as a cool opportunity to take advantage of. I guess this was the summer between my first and second year of graduate school. And I had nothing going on and sounded like a really fun thing to do. I was living in San Francisco in the Bay Area at this time. So taking a short plane ride down to Mexico City was totally doable. I wasn't, traveling all the way across the globe, which was nice. And yeah, it just seemed like a really good opportunity to kind of like stay, keep my brain kind of activated over the summer, where I would typically, end up going and doing some freelance work or kind of just getting out of school mode. And so I guess I liked the idea of just continuing to like stay in a thoughtful kind of critical mindset, even though it was just, maybe 2 weeks over the summer. And yeah, that's how we met each other.
Yeah. I remember we had this collaboration with this local, very small institute with a name I can barely pronounce. Do you remember?
I was gonna rely on you for that.
Casa El Hijo de Ajuizote.
Yeah, I think that's pretty convincing.
Founded by Diego Flores Magón, yep. Grandson of the famous, what's the name? Flores Magón, the Mexican revolutionary who founded this...
printing press?
Printing press and controversial political newspaper. Mm-hmm. Like the Charlie Hebdo of Mexico, yeah. early 20th century. All of his staff were like put in prison or, so it was very, politically, radical political newspaper. And, he founded this institute in the very house where the printing press was, and was still like a little museum of the printing press. Mm-hmm. And in that spirit, they also had their a riser printer there, and they would still engage in political activities, mm-hmm. Small scale printing, and had this beautiful roof terrace. I can remember.
Yep. Yeah.
So it was such a magical place to be.
Yeah, it was. I remember it was like such a rude awakening arriving for the first time, because I didn't realize how high the elevation of Mexico City was.
Yeah.
And I remember walking up the flights of stairs to this space and being like winded, and out of breath and sort of like spinning for a moment. And at that point, I was in fairly decent shape. That really took me off guard. I feel like it required a little bit of an adjustment and a reminder just to kind of slow down a little bit. But yeah, the space was really unbelievable. They had done an amazing job of kind of restoring and they had that exhibition space on second or third floor. Mm-hmm. And then that main area. I really loved that main area where the Riso printer was, and that kind of flexible modular workspace kind of in the center that could very easily be reconfigured. And you know what? One thing that I remember all the time is these like modular shelves that pulled down from the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
Those were really fun.
Yeah.
I always wished I could have gotten one of those for my apartment.
Yeah. And I think these modular systems, they were, weren't they built out of this system that street vendors use?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm.
Like I remember the story that street vendors, they have to pay some kind of fee in order to take a space. Mm-hmm. But when you hang something, they don't have to pay for the fee. So they will always like build some kind of hanging constructions.
Yeah, where it's not touching the floor.
Yeah. So that for me, I think, I was organizing, but I felt as much as a a participant or like a student of life as you may be there, that we were just exploring that old area. We were in the old town of Mexico City, mm-hmm. the Centro Histórico, and we would just, you could just like walk out of the door and life just unfolded. Mm-hmm. And you would have like plenty of stuff to research, from the systems that the street vendors used, the street food, the colors,
the smells.
Yeah, there was so much going on.
Yeah, it was chaotic, but it felt very real.
Yeah.
And I feel really lucky, you know, to have, that you all had been able to find that location for us to work in. It felt very, you know, authentic.
Yeah.
Like we were just kind of inserting ourselves into everyday life.
Well, I think here the credits go to my dear friend, Juan Arturo Garcia. He was at that time, he was like our local guide. Mm-hmm. He's now an artist, lives in the Netherlands. And he came up with the place because he heard about it and he laid the first contacts. And yeah, from there on, things happened. And what I also remember is that just around the corner, if you went out of the building, there was this square. I forgot the name. Something mm-hmm. like Plaza Santo Domingo, with all the printing presses. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you could just like walk up to one of his old...
Yeah, and Senor, commission them to print something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Senor Lalo. Or he's like, hey, here's my birth card or like my wedding.
Yeah.
And even on the other side of the square, there were people who could type a letter for you, like a resignation letter or just anything. You could like commission them to write something for you and then take the copy to the other side of the square and have Senor Lalo typeset your work, and within 4 hours, you'd pick it up in a small circulation.
Yeah, yeah. That was really cool to have that many resources and like vendors nearby.
Yeah.
I remember taking like a day, not even a day trip, but just a few blocks away was the ruins of a pyramid. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the name of this space?
I think that's the one in the center. Like I remember the name. It's the most famous one.
Temple of Mayor.
Temple of Mayor, yes.
Yeah. I remember taking a field trip over around the ruins there. I remember like learning a little bit about the history of how and why it had been constructed, and then thinking in some ways how it had been turned almost into like another version of Disneyland, with all of these walkways and entrances and things kind of leading you around this historic ruin. And that was, I don't know, I think that was one of the first memories I have from the trip, is going on that field trip.
Yeah, great. I mean, there were so many things just at your fingertips. You could just like walk out the building. And that brings me to this idea of, like embedded design, or for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
They were really, maybe to pair it with, or to contrast it with like regular education, I often experience that you sit with so many people in a classroom, like we are now. There's fluorescent lights, there's a printer, there's desks, there's a projection screen, and everything that you would expect from a art school or design class. How does it look like? And in this place where we went, like none of that was there. I mean, there was the riser printer, but it was so much more kind of
improvised.
Improvised and really like in embedded in real life. So you had to go out, you had to be active to engage with all these local people, and there was so much opportunity to do that. And for me, that was always so inspiring, this idea of a school without walls. So I've always cherished it as a kind of model how I would wish education would be, instead of all these institutional walls and
stuck in one place.
I'm also curious because, well, I mentioned already there's all kind of paraphernalia lying here, and there's also some stuff that you made there in Mexico,
right?
Maybe it's nice to talk a little bit about that.
What did
you do there?
So this is a book that we're looking at. It's very thick. It almost resembles like a brick. And this is a Riso printed book called Sus Valens. I remember when I first arrived in Mexico City, even at the airport, I was really surprised at how many police were located everywhere. And it wasn't just, you know, regular police officers that I'm familiar with coming from the United States, but these guys had like big guns. They were a very intimidating presence. And it just sort of like struck me immediately that this felt like a space that was very foreign to me. Mm. And yeah, kind of connecting back to your initial idea of School Without Borders, I feel like this project really came about because of my unfamiliarity with this place. Like, I would have obviously never made this book without that defamiliarization. And anyways, back to the book. The book is basically, as I mentioned, I was very surprised and kind of caught off guard by this presence. And so I started documenting, taking photos of the police with my phone, in most cases very secretly. And I think even at different points, some of the other students and maybe even you were taking photos on my behalf, sharing them with me. So the project ended up being this publication. I think it's 160 pages. That's basically a compilation of all of the photos that I took of the police in Mexico City. And so it's a photo book, and I kind of organized it around these very dry categories. So the categories which become the various chapters of the book, they include things like eating and drinking, getting shoe shines. I thought it was really funny. On more than one occasion, saw a police officer just standing there on the side of the side of the road getting a shoe shine. Walking, leaning on things.
They're it's just almost like comedians in cars drinking coffee, yeah. But then with the police.
You yeah, know, a little bit.
Police standing on the corner, having the shoe shine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, on one hand, these people that are supposed to represent, you know, government, you know, very political institutions, and seeing them doing just like regular things kind of, I thought was very funny. And so it seemed like a good idea to kind of record this experience in the form of a book. I think we printed 40 or 50 of them. And, you know, one memory that I have that really stuck with me was a couple of days before the final exhibition that we had at this space. I had all of the printing done. They had the sheets had been the pages had been sent to a local shop to punch a hole and to do the binding. To trim and punch holes. And then the final step was to bind everything. It's all bound with a clip. Mm-hmm. And I was about to stay up all night and collate and bind all of these books myself. And I think either you or Femke saw me doing this and you said, no, this is silly, John. Like, you can't do that. And so everybody pitched in and we collated all 50 copies of this book together. And we knocked it out in an hour or 30 minutes or something. And meanwhile, it would have taken me literally all night if I had to do it myself. So I always appreciated that gesture. And, you know, another example of a creative community kind of coming together with a common goal.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, finishing a simple project.
That's so great.
I always appreciated that.
Yeah. There was also another thing that I just came to my mind when you were talking about the police officer standing there. I remember in the first week we went on a few of these field trips with this Diego, mm-hmm. who was like also very well connected with all the street vendors, and I think he brought some anthropologists with them. Actually, dear listeners, this was Diego Flores Magón, a historian who was the founder of Casa El Hijo del Ajuizote in Mexico City, where we hosted the summer sessions in 2016.
It might be the case, I'm sure it's going to be the case, that you see this crazy interaction where people who are selling on the curb will hear like a certain whistle blower, and they will grab their stuff and pretend they're not doing anything.
And we were walking around the Centro Histórico, and I think there was a moment where probably, I think it was must have been you or maybe somebody else taking a picture of a police officer, and they were shouting something like,
don't do that.
And then Diego, so like, he got furious. He's like, of course he could take a picture. It's like, it's our fucking taxpayer money, man.
Right.
Like, he could take as many pictures if he wants.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So maybe this was just the response back, like, no, we're going to do this no matter what, no matter what you say.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do remember, I believe I filled up all of the memory on my cell phone at that time, which probably wasn't that much. And Yeah, I was definitely taking a lot of secret photos of the police officers, like, all over the city. So it was really fun. Like I said, I think there were other students in the program who were, like, taking photos on my behalf. So there may be some credit due to some of those folks for some of the photo credits. But yeah, it felt like a little bit of a radical idea, and maybe in the spirit of, as you mentioned, the place that we were working in, maybe I was adopting a little bit of that mindset as I was working on this.
Maybe it's not a highly political project, but there's a political side to it.
Yeah.
And would you say that sensibility was already present in some of your work before that, or?
No, not at all.
After? No?
No, not at all. I'm the most apolitical person you'll probably ever meet.
If you're listening.
I for sure have, you know, political views and, you know, my own personal belief system, but I don't typically sort of project those ideas in my work publicly, or at least not until this project.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it was coming from, but maybe it was just a new experience in a new country.
It was the spirit of Mexico City and the altitude that, that brought you to great heights.
There may have been something in the water.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. What I'm curious about for myself is that, as I said, this idea of school without walls is for me very much almost like an ideal way of education. Mm-hmm. If I would be able to have to restructure all of the education that I receive, but also give, mm-hmm. according to the model that we developed with the summer sessions, I would definitely go for that. I think mm-hmm. it's such a holistic way of doing.
Yeah.
Of being in the world and being a designer and engaging with the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I see it. But I'm curious how, for you, maybe some of the experience you had there were similar or different from experience you had before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned that there was no formal grading process. And I think in some ways that does kind of relieve the pressure a little bit to... I know while there were no grades, I do still I feel like everybody was very motivated to still make work that they felt proud of. And in some ways that alleviates a lot of the pressure that sometimes you might put on yourself that, oh, I need to get a good grade on this assignment. And it kind of frees you up just to think about, no, what do I want to make? Why am I here in the first place? And maybe it allows you to be a little bit more spontaneous, because that pressure is not necessarily there. Like I mentioned, I'm not, you know, an overly political person outwardly typically, but this space allowed me to take on a new persona that maybe I wasn't already doing in the past. So, and you know, you also mentioned that we were kind of we inserted ourselves into this very particular place that felt very, authentic and, yeah, it just real. And I feel like all of those experiences really helped allow you to just respond to things naturally rather than thinking about, oh, there's a formal assignment. I don't even remember if there was a formal assignment given at any point, or if it was just, I think it was just, there's this final show in 2 weeks and everybody should make something to kind of participate in the show. Yeah. And so I think that freedom was really useful for me.
Yeah.
I imagine for other people as well. And I can't remember, was everybody on the trip a graduate student, or were there undergrad students as well?
I'm not sure. I think that most were graduate students.
Right. Yeah. So maybe most of us were kind of used to that situation to begin with, where either there's a very loose prompt or, not necessarily a formal assignment. And yeah, I think that freedom was really helpful for me to not feel, you know, overly restricted by, oh, there needs to be a deliverable that is a book or a poster or, you know, a particular format or certain size or anything in particular.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just really appreciated the freedom, I think.
Yeah, I think there was no assignment, but we always started out with some kind of theme. I think mm-hmm. for Mexico, this was future archaeology.
Yeah.
But like you said, it was more a prompt, mm-hmm. something oh, what if we use, in Mexico, archaeology is so present, but what can we borrow from that discipline as designers, or mm-hmm. what ways of looking, what gazes can we adopt mm-hmm. if we look at all these layers that the city has on offer. But yeah, it was more like a starting point than, oh, you should at the end do something that responds to that.
Or, mm-hmm. yeah. I always remember, is it on this? No. There was an infographic that was made at the end of the 2 weeks that compared various timescales.
Oh yeah.
And I forgot what the shortest and the longest were, but do you remember what this was all
wasn't
about?
It some kind of calendar of like, yeah. all the rhythms in the street?
Rhythms.
Like when did the street vendors go up, when mm-hmm. the cycles.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that I still think about, you know, all the time. It's really stuck with me.
And we had we researched it throughout the 2 weeks, and we had it painted by one of these
vendors.
Yeah, this particular guy who would do all the signage for the vendors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This very meticulous kind of street calligraphy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I always remember that still. Yeah, I guess also part of it is just being like outside of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say, just experiencing a new place. You know, I had been to Mexico previously, but never to Mexico City. And I think just being, you know, exposed to new things, new languages, new cultures, new smells, new food. I remember eating crickets, I think, with you at some point. I think all of those experiences just kind of like take you outside of your comfort zone and maybe destabilize, you know, the things that you typically take for granted or the things that you just do automatically and make you reconsider. Just reconsider what you're doing and what you're working on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, plus to go back what we just said before, like, no, there wasn't a formal assignment, but there was kind of, well, an assumption or at least idea that we would produce something.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes that you're already in a place like that, not as a tourist, but as a maker.
Mm-hmm.
So you, everywhere you go, you look with the gaze of a maker.
Yeah,
you're looking for opportunities to make stuff at the end, to bring something together, and that creative impulse that you bring into that is already different than
mm-hmm.
just like staying in that comfort zone and being the tourist.
Yeah, yeah, and I think you know, like you said, there also was like a certain level of trust. Like, hey, you trust us that we know a thing or two, we know what we're doing. You can trust that we're going to make something at the end of the day. And I think just like right off the bat, instilling that level of trust in all of us is kind of a helpful way to just like get going on working on something. I do remember there were some students who maybe had a little bit of trouble just like getting going. I think maybe they spent a little bit more time, you know, simmering and thinking and stewing on ideas, and it took them a little bit longer to start making and kind of executing. And yeah, I think everybody has their own style of working. I, for one, like, I tend to be somebody who as soon as I get a prompt or an assignment, I like to just like go start making things.
Right.
And I don't just make one thing. I make 100 things. Mm. And, you know, of course there ends up being 99 that are stupid or dumb and they just go to the trash can. And then there's always a, you know, a little nugget or a kernel of an idea that can be turned into something. And, you know, I think that's what I made here in this book probably.
Yeah, beautiful. So this summer sessions program was, yeah, like 6 years ago. We didn't see each other for a couple of years, and now we're here together in New York. We're in your classroom where you teach. Yeah, you're a teacher or educator now, and we've already touched upon it a little bit. But how do you see your role now as an educator?
Yeah. It's strange to think that people are willing to like sit down and listen to me for 4 hours. Classes are 4 hours, okay. Which is like really difficult sometimes. Just the idea that somebody is, yeah, like willing to listen to me, for that amount of time is like very strange. That being said, I don't love having the spotlight on me. I think I said this to you earlier. And so the way I like to have classes that there will be some type of short lecture, but I really try to make the class more interactive and have students kind of support each other. Of course I'm here to help kind of herd the cattle, you know, keep the guardrails there, but I think it's really important for me that there's a classroom where students are interacting with each other and supporting each other. You know, it's not just me up at the lectern kind of speaking to everybody. It's kind of everybody collaborating together.
I once read an article where I think the author kind of outlined three archetypical roles of being an educator. And the first was, I think he described it as the sage on the stage.
The sage on the stage.
You know, this charismatic professor that knows everything, and like all the students are in awe because they have so much knowledge. And it's more like you're the sender,
right?
Which is out of tune with where old the world
school.
Is right now.
Yeah,
yeah, like, yeah. It's called old school. There's also a kind of response to that. Like the opposite is more like, oh, you make yourself completely invisible as a teacher, or you're more like, oh, guys, here's the assignment. I'll be here in the corner. You can hand it in before the end of the class. And there's another role which is more like, there is a challenge, or it is a problem, or it is a, how are we going to solve this? And then you are more like the, the facilitator of the conversation, or guide students to kind of solve the puzzle or face the challenge. But your role is a bit more kind of like in between. Of these three roles, and obviously there's much more, but like let's stick with these three. What role suits you best?
I think it's the third one.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think, I don't know. Maybe what I would compare myself to is like the umpire at a baseball game. You familiar with?
Oh, no. You have, really have to fill me in. I'm okay. European. We know nothing okay. about baseball.
or a referee at a soccer match. How about that? Yep. You know, somebody needs to be there to kind of like keep the guardrails in place. Mm-hmm. But I also try not to insert myself too extremely in most cases, kind of let things play out on their own. And of course, I'm here to assist and help out, you know, as much as I can and as much as students need. But when I look around and see students helping each other, like that's the thing that really makes me excited. When one student can kind of teach another student something, I love seeing that kind of like self-supporting one another.
Yeah. Do you have like tricks in the back of your, like how do you do that?
No, I don't. I mentioned earlier, I've only been doing this for 2 years. So I'm, you know, a little bit figuring it out as I go. I think initially I thought a teacher was supposed to be, you know, that first category that you mentioned, the sage. What is it? The sage.
The sage on the stage.
The sage on the stage. Yeah, I always thought that's what a teacher was supposed to be, and then I learned like that's not how I operate. That's not how I'm comfortable. And if I'm not comfortable, imagine everybody else. You know, watching me is definitely not going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
So. That's not me, and I'm figuring out how to kind of like play to my own strengths. And I would say, you know, like I thought it was interesting you described that second category as sort of like removing yourself to the background. But you know, I think that there's really no way that you actually could do that. Even the writing of the assignments or the writing of the prompts already sort of shapes the space in a very strong way. So even if you just give some assignments and sort of like move to the background, you're already leaving your fingerprint on that class, on right. that group of people in a large way.
Earlier on in this conversation, you mentioned something about more like alternative models of education or some ideas that you have. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, ever since I moved to New York, I've been learning about new spaces for learning. I have a list here in front of me, a couple that I've either experienced or have learned about recently. Index Space is a really cool alternative space in Chinatown here in New York. SSHH, which I believe stands for Sixth Street Haunted House, was a space in the Lower East Side, which I think is closed But they were offering kind of like continuing education classes and workshops and just like a creative community hub. Southland Institute, which is in LA, School for Poetic Computation, you know, there's many, many, many more, but those are just a couple that that I'm familiar with. And yeah, I wonder to myself, as somebody who's been a student of design for 6 years or more and spent $100,000 most likely on tuition fees, and now to see what's kind of going on out in the world with all sorts of new software and platforms and tools and just new things, like how relevant are all of those skills that I learned, you know, over the past 10 or 15 years? And do these new like alternative schools offer potentially a better, you know, a better solution for a fraction of the cost?
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. And well, we're talking about a lot of money here, like 100,000, you say, like it's a lot. So if you could spend that money, yeah. Should you bring that to like a big institute, or should you spend it like a little bit here and there?
Mm-hmm.
I think if I were to have to make that decision myself, I would find it hard because I feel like I'm still a bit like old school in my thinking, that I tend to think like, well, yeah, there's really value in studying at an art institute and having teachers around you that have offer experience and vision and can guide you not only over the course of a couple of months, but over like years. So yeah, I think there's value. Having said that, I think it's interesting to explore the idea, like what kind of knowledge or skills can you, let's say, buy, to put it like really flat, or mm-hmm. Where can you resource that?
Yeah.
And what are things that are very difficult and scarce to get? Like, you mentioned earlier trust. Can you buy trust in a program like that? Right?
Right.
Where do you buy a person who trusts you? And so like, well, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
This is an open question. I don't know. Maybe these places offer that, but
yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, some of them are very new and, you know, there's no accreditation, there's no diploma that you get after, you know, taking one of these courses or graduating from this program. I tend to be like kind of skeptical of the education system sometimes. And I wonder to myself, how much of it is just a transaction? Like, are you paying for this diploma to be a stamp of approval so that you can go on and get, you know, get that job at a Fortune 500 company or whatever the case may be.
This is not only about design education, right?
I
think it's more a broader trend, especially the Gen Z kids. They're kind of tapping out of that system that has been telling them like, oh, you need to study for 18 years mm-hmm. and you need to like pay all the tuition fee, because you need to have that college degree, because you need that job, because you need to have the mortgage. You have, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, call it like the hamster wheel, the rat race, or whatever you want to call it. What do people call it here? The hustle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, all those things.
Yeah, like all of those things, and I think they're not like buying to that anymore. Like this is not only a design thing. But so yeah, that's interesting because then the question comes in like where.
Yeah, well, you know, I mentioned I've spent probably $100,000 on design education over the course of my life. Meanwhile, some of the most interesting design that I see is from people who have never paid a dollar for a design course.
Right, right.
You know, or students are learning from YouTube videos or TikTok content.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is just sometimes funny. Like, okay, what did I get for all of this money? I'm sure I learned a thing or two, like quite a bit, but the way of the world is changing, and you know, now with YouTube, you can learn just about anything you need to.
Yeah,
like the basic skills.
Where do you see your own future as a design educator? Also, with this in mind, would you see yourself more like in this institutes like Baruch College, or maybe in some of these alternative spaces, or design yourself mm-hmm. Your own system?
Yeah, I don't know. I do think that currently working in like an established institution is probably a good thing for me, just to learn the fundamentals and how to put together a curriculum, figure out some learning objectives and those sort of things. But maybe that becomes a springboard to do something else later on. Last semester I was approached to teach an online class, which was a very new thing for me and a good learning experience. I think the most valuable thing that I learned was just like producing video content. And now that's actually something that I've turned into, or yeah, developing video content is something that I now try to apply to all of my classes, even the in-person classes. I find that the students just engage a lot more with video content. And if there's maybe, you know, a demo that happens in class, having them reinforce that skill, watching it as a video, is really valuable. So, yeah.
Says the print-loving, tote bag hoarding.
Yeah, exactly.
Graphic designer.
It makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know. You also said that you're interested in publishing, and publishing video is as much publishing as anything else.
For sure. Yeah. And actually, the class that I'm teaching this semester that you visited a couple of weeks ago is publishing, publishing design. And the way that I've approached the curriculum is not so much focused on a particular format or particular medium, but more of the idea of publishing at large, like taking an idea and bringing it out into the public. So that means that the project doesn't have to be always making a book or always making a poster. You know, it could be making a video or a blog post or a website. So I think, yeah, that's a really good point. It's like publishing is more than just books.
Yeah. And is this like your personal vision, or is it also the vision of the, like Baruch College, or is this your part of your assignment, or is this how you
deal with it? I like to think that that's something that I brought to the table. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. So, yeah, maybe I am changing and evolving more than I recognize sometimes.
That's great, because that's why we are having this conversation with you on Design Alchemy, because that's what it's all about. Like,
yeah.
how does the world change? How do we respond to that as designers? And yeah, then it can be that you are maybe like a print loving tote bag hoarding designer, but at some point think like, wait a minute, like, yeah, video is like, it's a very engaging way of publishing, and also questioning like, yeah, I'm in this institute, but what are other forms? I think for me that's about the essence of what design is, like questioning the standards around us and mm-hmm. how to be human in a world that is radically standardizing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't really spend a lot of time talking about my commercial design practice. I mentioned at the beginning, I have a day job. I work at an advertising agency. And almost exclusively, the content that we're creating is video content.
Right.
So sometimes I think of myself in like as two separate people. Like I have this day job where I, you know, make a salary and can pay the rent. Mm-hmm. And then I do all this other design activity on the side, you know, teaching and doing personal projects. And I wish I could do a better job of sort of melding those two things together as one, rather than feeling like I'm constantly split, you know, in two different ways.
I feel that's almost like the general mode here in New York. Like almost everyone I talk to either, like they have a day job and mm-hmm. something else. And more often than not, they introduce themselves to their, you know, like whatever side activities. Like, oh, I'm doing pottery. I'm a ceramicist. Like, oh, that's great. And you find out they work at a consultancy firm. Or
yeah. No, it's so true. And I was speaking to another design educator, asking for, you know, advice, like how do you kind of make this happen? And one of the things that she mentioned is like, you tend to think of New York as being like the center of the universe, but there's a lot of places outside of New York. And, you know, if you want to be, you know, teaching, for example, like maybe New York isn't the best place to do that because of the costs associated, cost of living and all right. that. Back to the topic of alternative education and versus traditional academic institution. I do think like the big value in being here in this computer lab, in this classroom, is like the community of students that, you know, are sitting side by side. And one of the things that I always say to the students is like, get to know each other. I'm always surprised at how halfway through the semester, the students pretend like they don't know each other, like they've never met each other. And then I find out that they have three other classes together. I'm like, no, you need to talk to each other. You need to become friends. You need to become, you know, colleagues, give each other feedback, because at some point in the future, you're going to get a big freelance assignment and you can't do it all yourself. And so who are you going to, you know, who you're going to call on to help? It's like the people that you're sitting next to in class. And I think that element of like creative community is something that's always been important to me. And I do see it happening here in this classroom, but I also think like these alternative education spaces are, you know, good alternatives as well.
Yeah. So cool. I really enjoyed this conversation and I want to thank you for your openness and honesty and self-reflection and sharing a little bit of your journey with us. And I'm very curious where it will lead you.
So am I.
Yeah.
So am I.
Just being this tote bag hoarder, print lover turned educator. But yeah, I feel like art education or design education will be part of your life longer. That's
I really hope so. It's something that I really enjoy doing. The class that I'm teaching in this classroom, it's on Thursday nights from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m. And so by the time I finish class, clean up, and actually leave, it's 11 right. o'clock. And, you know, it's been a long day and I'm tired. But I leave and I feel like so re-energized. And like, I just feel so much more motivated to come back the next week. And for me, that's kind of the signal that there's something here is working.
Yep.
And so I plan on continuing to do this. We'll see how long it goes. But I really, really appreciate the opportunity that you had asked me to participate in this project. And it's also been really valuable. You've visited two of my classes, I think, mm-hmm. at this point. It's been a really valuable experience to sort of see you, to be a spectator in your class, you know, and to learn, you know, the ways. I was always very impressed at how you're able to engage the class and just generate a really thoughtful discussion. You know, sometimes there are days when students just don't want to speak up. They don't want to say anything. And you have a really thoughtful and a really great way of just like pulling out that conversation that I was always very, I wish I could replicate that.
Well, thank you so much. These are very, very kind words. Make me feel humble. I think it's also the benefit of the newcomer that you, that I had in this case, but nevertheless, thank you so much. And I hope we can continue this conversation either on record or off record. And be in touch for a long time and keep on this conversation about education and where we stand in this. And maybe in 5 years from now, you have completely transformed the educational landscape here. There's a whole new experimental space. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm going to be the next YouTube design celebrity, content creator.
Looking forward to that. Well, John, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Design Alchemy is brought to you by GDA, which stands for Graphic Design Arnhem, a 4-year bachelor program in experimental graphic design. GDA is part of Arthez University of the Arts, location Arnhem, the Netherlands, Europe. I wish to make some acknowledgements and shoutouts because I don't make this podcast on my own. First, I would like to say a big thank you to all the guests in this podcast. Friends, if you're listening, you know who you are. A podcast like this would be nowhere without you. I also want to thank some colleagues from Arthez. Maaike van Neck, GDA Head of Department for Critical Support. Iris Janssen, Miret Pelholm, Marlies Staporsjes, and Elsje Buehler, all colleagues from Arthez University of the Arts, that help with distribution and promotion. And I would like to thank myself for coming up with the idea of the podcast and making it happen. And last but not least, I want to thank you, dear listener, to making it all the way until here. We make this content for you and truly hope that you got something out of this episode. If you believe you have a story to share for Design Alchemy, please send me an email. You can send it to h.grievink@arthez.nl. That's ARTEZ.NL. Everybody, thank you so much for working your magic.